So today is April 17th, 2013. We're at the Rasmussen Library at UAF, and we're with Robert Charlie. Thank you so much. It's an honor to have you here today. And Robert's really interested in recording his life memories and memories of the Minto people so that other people can have this knowledge for years and years to come. And this will probably be recorded over a series of interviews. So today's the first interview, and Robert wanted to talk about his parents and his ancestors today. So let's start then, Robert. Do you want to talk about your father first or your mother first, or how would you like to start?
My dad first.
Okay. Tell me about your dad, and give maybe his name first, and then tell me about him.
Okay. I was looking at some notes that my dad was interviewed by... Professor what's his name? Let me shut it off for
you. Okay. Well, we don't have to shut it off. We can keep going. Maybe were these paper notes, Robert, or had your dad made a recording?
It was written.
Oh, it was written?
Yeah, it was written. He also typed it out. And my dad was talking about where he came from and where his grandmother came from. And Michael Krause is the one that interviewed him in 1967.
Wow.
It was, I think, in June of 67.
Did Michael interview him in your own language, or was it in English, or was it in...
He was speaking in English.
Uh-huh.
And he was talking about where his grandma originated from. It was like there was another old village behind Nulato. Before they moved to the Yukon River. And my dad said his grandmother from Nulato moved up to Minto, and then from there, grandma's daughter was born there, and she moved up to Tanacross. And I have no idea what the connection is all about that made them move from Nulato all the way up to Tanacross.
Right.
And so my grandma on my dad's side married into Tanacross, and she had my dad and my uncle Jimmy. Two boys, and my dad was like 5 or 7 years old, and Uncle Jimmy was like 4 or 5 years old. And what my grandma on my dad's side was there amongst the people up in Ketchum Stock. And she lost her husband through sickness. And then this guy that had medicine power was trying to get my grandma to live with him. And he kept bothering her to do that. And my grandma mentioned that to the elders at their gathering, you know, in their community, they have a small gathering amongst the elders and they talk about things. So my grandma mentioned that, and he wasn't around, the medicine man. So the elders told my grandma, it would be good if you could maybe leave this place and go down to where your uncle Chief Charlie is, in that we'll be away from him, get away from him. That would be the safest thing, otherwise he'll probably hurt you through his medicine power. So they arranged to take my grandma. They sent two people with her from Ketchum Stock all the way over to Healy Lake area, cross country. And they went with her to carry the boys and help my grandma so she don't run into trouble. So when they got Healy Lake, the folks there at Healy Lake, the two guys that brought her to Healy Lake mentioned to the elders there at Healy Lake that were bringing our aunt, they call her, down so she could go make her way all the way down to Minto Flats. And right away they caught on to her with what the story was. And they, in turn, got two people would go with my grandma. This time they used a canoe. They paddled her down to Salcha. And from Salcha, she stayed there for a couple of days. From Salcha, these other guys went back from Salcha. They sent two people down to China with her. And it kept on like that. From China, they sent two people down with her to Nenana. And when she got to Nenana, they continued with the two people taking her all the way over to where the new village is at. That's where Chief Charlie's grounds were. That's where his village was. And there was only two cabins there at that time. So when my grandma brought my uncle and my dad to Chief Charlie, back then they really cherished the relationship between their connection as a family. So he took my grandma and he let her stay with him, and he took these two boys under his wings. And he taught them everything about hunting and trapping and all that. And that's how my dad and my uncle lived in Minto. And somewhere along the line, my grandma, my dad's mother, was buried in a cemetery on Goldstream, where that used to be the major burial ground. And my brother Neil one time went over there and he said, "This is where my grandma's grave was." Oh. It's just, you know, you couldn't tell.
Yeah.
It's been so long ago.
Right, right.
So my dad was brought up there in the Minto Flats area. And to continue the story on my dad, he became a very good hunter. He provided for a lot of people that lived, couldn't afford themselves with subsistence food. So he provided a lot of food like that. And on my grandma's side, my mother's mother, Annie Glass, she was living in Cochrane's, and old David heard about her, and old David paddled all the way down to Cochrane's, and he went down there to pick up my grandma, and paddle all the way back to Minto Flats. That's a long way to paddle.
Yeah.
And that's how my grandma moved into Minto Flats. Minto Flats were very good for a lot of fish and a lot of waterfowl, a lot of different things. That's why people come and start living in Minto.
Right. Just so we have it on the recording then, Robert, what was your father's mother's name? What was your grandmother's name on your father's side?
My mother on my dad, my grandma on my dad's side, was her name was Delia. And on my mother's side, her name was Annie Glass.
Annie Glass, right. Uh-huh. And what was your dad's name? You didn't mention
Moses that. Charlie.
Moses Charlie, okay.
And their grandparents before them only had Indian name.
Right, and what were they? What were the Indian names, do you know?
No, I have no idea what their Indian names were.
Right, right.
But from my dad's mother and my mother's mother, from there I could continue
with the, yeah, with the names. And the names started to get changed from Indian names to English names when the missionaries came, or do you know?
Well, they started, my dad was born according to his Fish and Wildlife application in 1939. He was 50 years old then, so he was born in 1889.
Right.
And Uncle Jimmy was born a few years after. So when my dad was born, then in 1909, somewhere in there, is when my dad and my mother got married.
Oh.
And there's no records of their marriage. But my sister was the oldest daughter they had, Dorothy Titus. She passed on a few years ago. And she was born in 1910. So that's how I started figuring out how the years were. And it was like just before 1900, was when the missionaries start coming and giving names. My dad's name, given name, was supposed to be Abraham, last name. And when the missionaries came, they changed it to Charlie because he was under Chief Charlie Sween.
Right.
So my dad has a half-brother in Tanacross. His name was Sam Abraham. And his granddaughters are still living. When the missionaries came, with my grandma on my grandma's side, my mother's side, she already had a last name, a Glass. And my grandma on my mother's side, I think she was really light-colored, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother was also a light color. So my grandma probably had mixed relatives.
Right, right.
And then my grandma, while she was still living in Cochrane's, there was two boys that lost their mother and their parents. One was Joe Wright and one was Arthur Wright. And my grandma adopted Arthur Wright. That's where the Wright boys come from. I adopted my Arthur Wright, and when Arthur was about maybe in his teens, he decided to take up ministry. And they sent him out to a missionary school for about 5 years. And that's when he met his wife, Myrtle Wright. And they got married out there. And And my grandma is already living in Minto by then. And my grandma, she passed on in 1936.
And that's your dad's mom that passed? My mother's mother. Okay.
And I remember I was just about 9 years old. And we were living in a fall camp on the Tolumana River. And when my grandma died, she died of heart attack. She was always trying to work, you know, and she was carrying wood when she had heart attack. And then it was only my family was over there with my grandma. So my two brothers, I think it was Neil and Sirosky, or Timothy and Sirosky, who were my brothers, older brothers, that paddled their body all the way down to Ominto, which is take all day paddling. And they paddled her body all the way down to Minto. And Uncle Arthur Wright was there in 1936, him and his wife. And he had two or three boys. And my brother Al Wright said he remember when they brought Grandma's body back over to Ominto. Mm-hmm. So it was between three of them that dug a grave for my grandma. Wow. And buried her.
Do you remember your grandmother? Do you have any memories of your grandma?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, what?
Yeah. You know, Ominto, they had a building what was built for like school. And then they had church that was built for the church. And the guy that built both buildings, he used to trap way above for the new villages at on the Tolvena. And he was really a carpenter. He rethew those trees just like this, just like boards. And both that two-story building, it wasn't two-story, it was on the bottom was kind of a root cellar, it was built up, and then the top was living room and this one-room school. And that's where my uncle Arthur Wright started this schooling. That's where he taught the kids there. And then he also taught the missionaries to our people there. And my uncle Arthur Wright, besides the church and the building where they built her school, he built another building for my grandma. And my grandma didn't live too far from them, so we would always be at my grandma's place because she was always cooking something, you know, both from Wrights and our family. So that's how we got really connected back then.
Right.
And somewhere along after the Wright boys moved to Nenana, Uncle Lars Wright moved to Nenana in the 40s, and that's where they started raising three or four boys. And there's Al, Garrett, and there's the third one. They're still living. And Al was a pilot when he got out of the Army in the early 40s, mid-40s. First thing he did was he got a GI loan and started flying. Went to school for flying, and then he bought a plane. And he's been our bush plane pilot for all these years, and he's the one that started the Wright's Air Service.
Very interesting, right.
And he's retired now, but he's still got a plane. He flies down around the flats once in a while. He's about a year older than I am. And on my grandma's side, That was my story about my grandma. And when she had my mother, there's a picture of my grandma before she moved to Cochran's. And she was living in a tent, and there was a little girl with her. So I think that was my grandma, my mother. Mm-hmm. And so when old man David, old David went down to pick her up, they lived together all 8 times until old David passed on before my grandma. Mm. Old David was really a really hard worker. Everything he did, he always broke and cut trails and made caches and all that kind of stuff, wherever he's at. And I think we took on that skills from my dad and my grandma on my mother's, on old David's side. That's why I still try to do things today, even on my age.
Mm-hmm. What was your mother's name, Robert?
My mother's name was Bessie, mm-hmm. Bessie Charlie. She's originally Bessie David. And my mother's story is another different thing. My mother and my dad got married, and they started off with one daughter, Dorothy. Mm-hmm. And from there, all the way down to my last sibling was Rita. She was about 5 or 6 years younger than I am. And between that, there was another Charlotte. And she passed on in 46. And between the time my sister Dorothy was born, to Rita, the last one in the family, there was about 11 of us, I guess, that was born.
Wow.
And the story that's behind this, in spite of raising my kids, my mother, at mid-age, she turned blind. So I think she could still see when my sister Dorothy was born, my oldest Dora Sorosky, Timothy, and I think when Neil was born in that area, which when she took on blind. She, in spite of her blindness, today I think about it, my mother must have the power to do things that she did. She took care of her family just like she could see. She cooked, she baked, and she did all these things just by the feel of her hand. That's why I think today that the Lord must have been her on her right-hand side,
right,
just showing her around. A lot of times when I was living with my mom and my dad, I used to feel sorry for my mom. And I helped her as much as I can. And when she's pouring tea in the cup, she had to feel with her hand, and everything with her hand. And if she is cooking baking bread, she has a little oven, and she has to fill it in with just so it barely hit the top with her hand. These things, in spite of all that, she sewed our clothes, she made our clothes, our moccasins, our mittens, our hats, and our parkas. And she did that for all of our kids. And on top of that, she tanned her own moose hide, she tanned her own caribou hides, she tanned all her beavers, everything, just on and on like that, just like a woman that could see. And And I felt a lot of real sorry for my mom, even that she would try to go out and cut wood, what we did when we were there with her, when I was a kid, we would bring the log to her and then she would saw it, just like that. And it was amazing how my mom really survived with the handicap she had. And there's nobody knows about my mother except our family. How she raised us up, and she disciplined us a lot. My dad also did. That's why I am the way I am. They told me not to do these things, not to think about other things than what you're supposed to be thinking about. My dad, on the other side, was a really rich man. While my mother was doing things like that, my dad would be out trapping or hunting. He'd bring home spruce hens, grouse, or rabbits, so to keep the family going. And my dad is always bringing stuff home because he was really a woodsman. And one thing about my dad, he was a person that wanted to be alone all the time in the woods. He didn't want to take us, but he showed us how to hunt and trap. So in this note that my dad was talking about, Michael Krause, he mentioned a time that he went bear hunting in the fall. And just outside of Minto, there's a hill we call Tahade. And Tahade had a lot of graves caves where bears would hibernate. And he went to one of those. There was other boys with him. They went out hunting just to catch bears in the fall, and that's when they usually do that. And in his story, and he told us too when he was still living, he said, they came to this cave and you had to crawl in there if there was anything in there. And everybody didn't want to crawl in there. And there was about 10 other guys. And my dad said, I'll go in. So he had his rifle. And then when he got in, he had his matches ready in his pocket. And his strike match was his gun, you know. Mm-hmm. And he could see that there was three eyes looking at him. And while the match was still burning, right away he loaded up his gun, the match went out, he lit another match, shot that one, this, and three of them. His ears must have really got. So, although he wasn't sure if he really shot them, my dad crawled out and told him, give me a rope. And he went back in with a knife this time. And then when he crawled in, he lit a match where that first one was. And then the match went out and he slowly crawled and he said he feel the hair, see if that bear was breathing. It wasn't breathing, so he tied a rope around his neck. And he told those guys, he crawled back out and he told those guys to pull him out. They pull him out and it was the mother mother grizzly bear. And then he took the rope and he went back in and he did the same thing. He light the match and they see the mouth. They didn't see the eye, but he see where that other bear was. So he went in and let's see if it was breathing. So he tied again. All three of them, he did that. No man would ever do that. So my dad told us about it. He said, you're supposed to know these things. If you feel you can do it, do it. He said, that's the way I survived when I'm all by myself out in the country. I went down to my dad. So my dad, when he's going out somewhere, and then maybe he'd go for birch or something to make sled snowshoes, even in the fall or the spring, he would take a spear without a gun. He'd take a spear because he knew how to use it. He said one time the elders before him, they got a bear with a spear. They wait till the bear charged them and they would put that spear in the ground like this and let the bear fall on it. That's how they use it. They can't poke them like that. So he told us a lot of stories about how to survive. And that's a very interesting part. On my mother's side and my dad's side, I think I had a very good parents too, that was my role model.
And did you speak your language at home, Robert? What language did you speak at home?
They spoke with us in our language, and that's where I picked up a lot of on our language. And my grandma, my mother always tried to speak English because the kids were all speaking English by then. Right. And although my mom was still broken language, and my dad spoke English also. I was born in 1927. And by the time I got 13, I had to drop out of school when I was 13. When I was about 13, and my dad, all the family is gone. My brothers were married and all that, and I was the only one with my mom and dad, besides my two sisters. In the 40s, early 40s. And my dad, somehow arranged to get contract on wood cutting for the seamers, 4 foot length. And the first one he got contract with was 50 cords. And where we had our fish camp had a lot of timbers, good timbers. So we cut the 50 cords, and I would haul them into the bank with 6 zonks that we had. And across from us was old Johnny Campbell, the storeman. Old Johnny Campbell was an Irishman, and he was looking for gold behind where the new village is. And our people knew he was back there, and they check on him once in a while. And they find out he was having a hard time because he had no food. So they help him right there, and he say, "What can I do to help you people?" The elders back then, they say, "A store near Old Minto would be good." And that's what he did. He put a store there, And he managed that stove for, when I was a kid, all the way up to the 50s. And my dad would buy food from him, and then when my dad would get the check, he would pay him off. My dad was cutting the wood at $7 a cord. Then the second year, he got another 60 cord contract. Because by then, trapping was kind of, you know, it wasn't worth it. And the third year, my dad talked to the people in Minto. He said, let's do a big contract. And they did the village there sign a contract for 1,000 cords. And it was all the family. They cut a little bit here and there. Some would cut 25, some would cut 10 or 15 cords. And then when they got done with the cutting wood in April, they had 1,060 cords piled up in various places. In ours alone, we had 75 cords. Because I was the one that was stacking them, where other people were stacking 6 feet, just sort of the challenge to stack mine 8 feet high. And we had three rows, 25 cords each.
It's a lot of wood.
Yeah, and then in 1945, when I started working for the Alaska Railroad on the steamers, we would haul our own wood that I piled, and the guys there said, this is the only stack that's 8 feet high, all the rest are six. And I tell them, because I did it. I wanted the challenge, you know. And the first mates and everybody really liked me, because they encouraged me to take on the levels, you know, second mate, first mate, a fireman, and then the pilot, and then the chief.
Mm. Can we just go back? You mentioned that you went to school until you were 13. Where did you go to school? Was the school in
Minto
itself, so you didn't have to go far away?
We had one for, 1938 was, and before 38 was when we were going to school at this old building my uncle had built. And then in 1938 is when they got the new school, which is still standing. In 1938, it took them 2 years to build that. First they did was they had some maybe 2 foot creosote poles. They sank them down about 4 feet, and those are still standing because they're creosote. And then they on top, and then 4 feet up, then they still start building the foundation. And that building is still standing there. And the two people that did the contract were both Germans. And they did the whole building. And then we start going to school there in 1939. And that's when I went to school there a couple of years, and I had to drop out in third grade.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then you mentioned your dad had a trap line. Where was his trap line located? Is it the same area every year?
On the trap line, in the written material we're going to provide, it's going to show the 500,000 acres that we used in the Minto Flats area. And beyond that also. So that's going to be shown in the material we're going to provide.
And it was good for trapping that country.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I we, our stomping grounds for trapping was for the New Minto, is that. Everybody else were out in the flats. And we would go all the way over to West Fork area for our trap line. And that's a long ways from the old village.
And they'd go by dog team?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it's quite a run. There's a story behind that also. Mm-hmm. It took us 2 days to get over there from the village. One to where the new village is. So we had a small little cabin there. And no wood floor, no floor, just spruce bough. And from there we would go up, climb up the ridge, up the hill, and cross over the Elliott Highway and over into West Fork. Another day, another whole day. So it would take us 2 days to get from Old Minto over to. And mileage is probably about 50 miles, something like that. And we would stay in tent over there and do our trapping in that area.
And that's when fur prices were good.
Yeah. And then back then, you never get tired. All you need is food. When we would do our trap line, we'd go back to the camp and we would eat something. And especially when the moon is moonlight, we would take up our dogs, go down to the halfway point and camp over, and the next day go home. It was really exciting traveling in the moonlight. The dogs like that. They always expect to see something, so they go a little faster than they would in daytime. So it was just like a thing you had to do, you know. The way we were living, it was something that you had to do. It's like going to work 8 hours a day. But on a trap line, you were traveling more than 8 hours a day. All on snowshoes. No skis, just snowshoes. And that's where I think I really got my, broke in myself to where I can do all those things yet if I had the strength. And I knew how to do all those things. So people talk about the old days and a lot of them don't even know what it's like, the old days. At the old times, my dad, my mother, always told me how it was before our time, even before their time, the way people had to survive. So it was kind of educational before my time, and it was educational in ancient times. In ancient times, they had small groups traveling, bands all the time. They had three or four families. And then there was always elders that traveled with them. And they would look after the elders. It was the community or the band's responsibility to look after their elders. That's how we, and they never had a set community, you know. They were always moving from subsistence to subsistence, and on four times a year.
So in the summer it would be fishing?
Spring, summer, fall, winter.
Mm-hmm. So, but what would you do in all the four seasons? In the summertime it was fishing?
Yeah.
And then in fall time, what?
Springtime would be for fresh fish gathering. And they have a spot in Minter Flats for that. And along with that, in my time, we used to hunt muskrats. And that would provide food also, as well as the fur. In the summertime, we would move from the muskrat in June, and through June, we would start thinking about building the fish wheel. And then salmon August used to start up at Tanana around the 4th of July. We always got our first salmon. And then they were big, there were no little salmons. Our kings were about 4 or 5 feet long. And then at, in August, September is when we do our berry picking. September is when we start providing for our moose hunting. And then in August, September through November is when we start settling down for things about fall weather. And then the winter is when they start moving from area to area for trapping and hunting. So that would fill the 12 months.
Mm-hmm. Always moving.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So how old was your dad? I mean, did he work really hard up until he died, Robert? Mm-hmm. Your dad, he lived a good long time. He worked very hard until he died.
He quit when he was about in his 60s. Mm-hmm. But my dad, I have pictures of that and will still use that. He was really handy with his making the stick spoons, stick plates. He even made wooden shovels. And he was really handy with all the things, sled making and snowshoe, filling in the snowshoes with babiche and all that stuff. Him and Mom would slice a babiche, I remember. And they would make it real thin and they would make rawhide out of moose hide. So everything they didn't have to buy. So it was really educational for what I've seen. And we will try to provide all that as we go along in sketches or either photos.
Right, okay. Mm-hmm. Well, your parking meter is going to run out in about 15 minutes. It's 20 to 11 now.
Oh.
So was there any other story you wanted to tell today, or did you want to, we'll pick up from here the next time?
I think I covered pretty well on my mother and my grandma's side. And my dad also had a whole lot of stories.
Maybe next time we can pick up with the stories your dad used to tell then.
Yeah.
We'll do that next time?
Yeah, and then I would bring the material that I am, notes that have been taken and all that. And then maybe I can get the correct name of this old village behind Ulado from Dr. Krause.
Right. Okay. Okay, so until next time.
That's it.
Good.